And now, your Chilpack Hollywood Hour with Dean Haglund and Phil Lairness.
Hi, everyone. Here we are in the offices of Rational Exuberance in the heart of the historic core in the middle of the Art Deco wonder that is the Eastern Columbia. Now rate it the number 3 in the pool douchiness factor on LACurb.com. I don't know why.
What?
Yes, the Eastern Columbia rooftop pool has got a 3 rating on the douche factor. I don't know how they've found that out. But
Simon Cowell is always so funny on that show.
The douche factor. I love that show.
I am Phil Lairness.
You are, thankfully.
This is your Chilpack Hollywood Hour, as the song and Dean Haglund mentioned.
Yes.
And no matter how you listen to us, whether you listen to us on Jack's website, we should join Stitcher, I guess.
Why don't we?
I mean, because you don't get metrics. You don't get to know how many people are listening.
Oh.
It's just out there. But do we care? We don't care.
We don't sell advertising, do we?
No, we don't.
We do this all.
By year 10, we'll get around to that. That's been on the to-do list.
For a long time
sell
now.
Sell advertising.
Right.
If somebody wants to
buy an ad,
pay us, yeah. I mean,
we'd be happy to.
We certainly support everything that anyone who listens to the show is doing. We're here for you.
That's great advertising right there. That's a commercial. Please support everything that everyone...
We like everything you're doing.
That's awesome. That's our new catchphrase.
Oh, my goodness.
Fantastic.
I have... I received a few compliments about last week's show.
Really?
So it's always nice when you get those after
so long of doing this show
to know we're finally... We're finally on to something.
Oh, I thought you were going to say a dry spell where you hadn't received any compliments. Has that been the case?
Well, I think there's some times where people, understandably and rightly so, don't feel the need to tell us every week that they like
awesome.
Everything we're doing. That's our job, to tell them that they like everything they're doing.
That's right.
It's just, I think it is always interesting when, I'll hear more than the usual amount.
Right.
About a particular show.
Okay.
And it's always kind of, I guess, pleasantly surprising when it comes out of the blue.
Right.
You know, if there's a certain theme show we're doing or if there's a...
A guest.
A particular guest, then
yes.
There's certain things you can anticipate. It was fun. I mean, we just were at a slightly different location last night.
Slightly different location.
Might have been drinking a little bit more than we ordinarily do.
Because it was later in the evening, perhaps?
Yes, it wasn't early Monday morning.
Right, when we're getting over our drinking.
And one of these lovely compliments came from Ulrika this morning in an email where she asked a few questions that I think we will actually inadvertently answer.
Okay.
Based on the show that we have planned.
Fantastic.
However, for the most part, you didn't get in under the deadline. We only have a hard and fast deadline.
Is there a deadline?
But I went back and I finally addressed or found a couple of messages, a couple of emails from listeners that we had been a little bit tardy in answering. This week seemed like a good week to address them.
Let's answer them.
So, Ulrika, if there's anything we don't address, we'll get to it next week.
There you go.
Of course. On a show a couple weeks ago, we got into this discussion, this theme about time travel.
Oh, yes. I love time travel themes.
And
it's funny that it's a couple weeks ago because it seems it was just yesterday. See?
Oh, my goodness. Good night. Walking here today, had another one of these moments. Very cool. Walking past the beautiful Orpheum Theater.
Oh, yeah.
There on the marquee, it says Richard Burton's Hamlet.
Yes, exactly.
I would like tickets to that.
That 1968.
Wow.
Wasn't it?
So clearly they're using it as a backdrop for shooting something, maybe for a commercial.
I have no idea. I thought they were actually going to show Richard Burton's Hamlet, but I guess not. Aren't they? Isn't it part of the LA Conservancy thing? I didn't look at it closely. I just saw Richard Burton's Hamlet.
See, I naturally thought
that it was
why
just,
I say naturally, I don't know, but that it was a marquee being used for a shoot
back in the 60s.
They were advertising his
movie,
his stage production.
I see.
Did he do a movie version of Hamlet?
I guess he didn't.
I don't know. I mean, maybe he did. Maybe.
Wow. Well, you're right.
So but maybe see, that's what I assumed. I always assumed there's so much shooting going on around here.
Yes.
That was
the backdrop.
That was why.
That's right, because back over at the tower, they were showing Godfather in a period piece, too, and then they would have all these 1970s transit buses driving around downtown. It fooled everybody for a while. But yeah, I thought, did Richard Burton do in Hamlet? Let's search that as quick as a wink to find out. Because
I'm looking up our information right now as we. This is not. This is fascinating for people to be listening to me looking up things.
A Richard Burton IMDb search.
I mean, it would have been in the 1960s, right? When he was at the peak of his powers, he did indeed do a 1964 Hamlet. Version of Hamlet.
Yeah. So I think that's
directed and photographed by Bill Collarin and co-directed. By John Gielgud.
Wow.
So that would actually be kind of an interesting
production.
To see.
Yeah. So awesome. Well, there maybe that's at the Orpheum.
Maybe it is. We'll find out.
I can't wait.
A little bit later. I guess, though, it does certainly bring us to your live event of the week.
The Chilpack Hollywood live event of the week.
I would like to discuss two live events. Did you see anything?
I did, but I saw Lady Diana's exhibit at the Queen Mary. Not really a live event. It's more her clothes.
How was that?
Sort of fascinating. It was more, there was royal letters, and they actually had a British phone booth, and you could pick up the phone booth. And one of Lady Diana's friends kept a recorded message so you could actually hear her voice from beyond the grave saying, hey, I'll come see you later.
Okay, was she royalty before marrying Charles?
Well, she was of the Spencers, and they were the 8th Earl of Spencer, okay. Technically in the House of Althorp, if I'm not mistaken. So they were royalty adjacent, I believe is the term.
Royalty adjacent, which kind of describes the Queen Mary now.
It's true.
Because I initially have a little bit of misgivings about her clothes being on display on the Queen Mary and as a royal display. But if you're saying that she was royalty going in, because she did she get to keep any title when she and Charles divorced?
No, she kept lady. But she had to drop HRH. She couldn't use HRH.
She was still considered Princess Diana.
She was still considered Princess
Diana. She
was? Yes, after. Well, afterwards. But she couldn't use her HRH moniker. So, which is the...
How did she see without that HRH moniker? Oh, I'm thinking monocle.
Hilarious.
Welcome to our worst show ever. So, like I said, live event of the week. What was the most interesting part about it?
You know what? That it portrayed Prince Charles to be quite the douchebag, I got to say. He's not coming across very nice in this exhibit.
And
that's fascinating.
Are we likely to see him at the rooftop pool? Is he that? What an unfortunate theme has emerged in this show. So let me ask you this then about the Lady Diana exhibit.
Yeah.
Was she a candle in the wind?
The Elton John album was there, signed.
No.
Yep, they had it in his
lap. And that whole album is that one song.
Yeah, just over and over again.
The song was always...
About Marilyn Monroe?
Durable.
Yes.
When it was about Marilyn Monroe. All those added verses and the thing, I mean, it went on forever. Boy.
Good times.
That just sucked the heart, life out of me.
Okay, so, what's your live event of the
week? Well, I saw... Where the Great Ones Run for a second time.
Oh, yeah.
Over at Rogue Machine. And it was a lot of fun because, you know, our friend Tucker Smallwood is in the play. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how much I spent, what time. It's set in a truck stop diner in Indiana, rural Indiana, the Bible Belt. And I don't know how much I've talked about on this show when I discussed the play, but I revealed some things over on Combat Radio when I was guest hosting about this, because it's an incredible play visually. I mean, I don't want to give anything away.
Don't give it away.
Listening talks about this, but this is the set design. I mean, it's pretty groundbreaking.
Okay.
And also, there's 13 characters, and the set is quite impressive, both in terms of its staging and also, again, the visual design of everything and the multimedia. Can't give anything away.
Holy smokes.
I had a great time because Tucker, his character, is seated almost throughout in this corner seat in the diner on this far corner of the stage by the exit to the set's restroom.
Okay.
Not to the theater's restroom.
Right.
And the first time I saw the show with, you know, the best seats in the house, I thought, ooh, Tucker has an amazing perspective on this show.
Right.
Getting to watch
everything.
And comment on it. That's kind of his, a little bit kind of a Greek chorus.
Gotcha.
So I grabbed the seat as close to where Tucker's seated on stage. And the cool thing is that the bottom row in this house is, you know, in this theater, is at stage level.
Ah, right.
And so I really got to kind of approximate his view on the play. And, of course, with 13 characters, and it's fun to see a show, first of all, that you want to see more than once, but also where when you take a totally different seat in the house,
yeah,
you're seeing a much different play.
Yes.
Of course, the play has deepened in the month since I first saw it. A lot of the transitional material that was kind of messy the first time I saw it is now becoming really subtle and
right.
really incredible stuff. And so the range of colors expressed, it's amazing how just subtle changes in energy can
alter the show.
A huge range of emotions and colors. Also, though, seeing the show, seeing a stage play from a different
angle,
different perspective, it can become such a different experience.
Which is great for a director to actually do, to see it from different, to get that feel of how then to direct.
It's why, you know, in an age where everything is storyboarded and pre-visualized, why, you know, what you miss out on, and it's not that anything is, you know, better or worse than any other approach. It's just that one of the things that you do miss out on if you don't take the time to do it is giving the set to the actors first, watching what their instincts are, letting them kind of block the scene, and then seeing if you find, as you move around them, based on their own instincts, maybe more interesting, you know, visual approaches.
Right.
Which, of course, you get to do in documentary.
Yeah, yeah.
And certainly was why I was constantly on the move in Truth Is Out There. But there's very few plays, surprisingly, where you really get that sense that if I sit in a different place in the house, I'm gonna get a different show.
Right.
And when I do get to see shows like that, I do see them several times. Like I did with Circle Mirror Transformation, which I did with La Bette, which I mentioned, you know, a Sacred Fool show, which I mentioned when we interviewed Jamie and French Stewart about Stoneface.
Right.
So that was a lot of fun. And it reminds me, you know, even in film, you would think that in film, well, that's why we want to watch things again and again, because there's always so much more that we can see.
Right.
But sadly, I think certainly over the better part of the last 30 years, that's become less so.
Less so.
Because more and more of our attention is directed by the director.
Right. And the camera choices and all of these things.
I used to joke when I was young and we were up against it in terms of scheduling, so we knew we had to bang out a scene in a master.
Right.
Because we didn't have time to go in for coverage. I used to joke and say, oh, that's fine. Coverage is fascist because it directs the audience's attention.
Right.
Master shots are democratic because it allows an audience to go where they want to go. At the same time, like any joke, there's some truth in it.
There's some truth in it. It's so true.
While we're still on the subject of live events of the week, this is not our live event, but I kind of was, my head was rocked back when I saw the headlines about this. Mike Tyson's one
yes.
Broadway show.
Isn't that something?
Directed by Spike Lee.
Yeah. Don't you want to see that?
Where did you come down on the resurrection of Mike Tyson? I saw that documentary.
Yes.
James Toback's documentary. It was a fascinating documentary.
Right. And,
Where do you come down on this?
I think the guy is trying. I mean, there is something to be said for forgiveness, and something that you would hope that a guy can possibly change his stripes. See what I... Because he has tattoos
nice.
On his face. Change his stripes.
Conveying forgiveness into a lucrative money-making franchise.
Is he, though? I mean, What,
I don't know. I don't know what his financial situation is at all. He is, of any former boxing champ, though, he is the one most in the public eye and the most beloved, it seems.
Well, fascinating. I mean, there's, you know, definitely a troubled guy there who took out those troubles in a ring. And then when that...
And on, you know, whoever his on whoever else, partner
when the was. Ring fell apart, there was like, yes, there was other problems that spilled over into his personal life, where you, if you saw the documentary,
and that,
you realized...
And I'm shocked. I'm always shocked that anyone who's in a business that that is all about encouraging and nurturing your violent tendencies would find those violent tendencies spilling out in their personal lives.
Well, technically, those violent tendencies are directed towards a... craft, a sport that he had a coach that actually was very helpful and then died prematurely, it seemed, in his life. If that coach had lived longer, perhaps Mike Tyson wouldn't have gotten into the later troubles.
Well, it is interesting. You know, I mean, I have certain misgivings about the resurrection. I'm always about, you know, forgiveness, and people deserve
second
chances.
Multiple.
We're all human and all this. It gets a little tough for me when someone's done time for, you know, sexual assault and,
right.
and things like this. And at the same time, though, you know, he is a fascinating figure because he has had among the ugliest personal experiences outside the ring, both
played
before
out.
Being a boxer and afterwards, played out
in
public setting. And at some point, as a public, we do have to acknowledge our responsibility in all these
Absolutely.
Sort of things. You know, if the biting of the ear shocks us, if the violence against women shocks us, well, maybe we ought to look at who we're championing in the first place and why we're championing that.
Right.
What we're championing.
What are we celebrating at that point?
What are we celebrating? So what's our responsibility?
Right. So I don't know if you're going to go to the show. I don't even know if I am. I still got to see Book of Mormons, for crying out loud. How far behind am I? So I'm going to get a chill pack while you say...
Oh, well, I was going to ask you whether you're still reading the same books. What you've been reading?
Yes, I still
don't. Why don't you wait till you're on mic?
Because, you know me.
I'm not going to be getting quite around. So many compliments about this.
Yes, you are. I think they're going to love the looseness of it. I think I'm still reading that, and I'm reading...
You're still reading that?
That. The Americans Abroad.
Right. David McCullough.
David McCullough's book. And, of course, Dr. Jack Daniel's book on running.
Because, is it really Dr. Jack Daniel?
Can you believe it?
I can't believe it. I was so interested in the running stories itself that I don't think that part registered with me last week.
That's
now
right.
that I sound like I've been up all night with Dr. Jack Daniel.
He's been helping me run. We're doing 9 miles. We got... our schedule is set for the next 18 weeks till the Long Beach Marathon, which we were in Long Beach last weekend, of course, to drive the 26 miles to see exactly where we'll be running. And it's going to be a pretty flat course, but it's going to be long.
As you drove it, did you have like friends every couple miles hand you water bottles?
No, what we were cheering the opposite people just walking. Way to go! Way to walk that 26 miles! We were doing that. So,
were you practicing, like, what came up as needed in the half marathon? Were you practicing turning grimaces into mugging for the camera when you realized that there were shutter clicks around you?
Yeah, I was doing that, as always. So you'll be seeing that at mile 25. That'll be a good look.
I am still reading Stephen Jacobs' Boris Karloff, More Than a Monster, the authorized biography. And this week I read about his return to the stage with the Broadway and then touring production for several years at the height of his movie stardom of Arsenic and Old Lace.
Ah.
Of course, the original play, the original production of this. And what a phenomenon this was. And two things that kind of surprised me to learn about it, because I always wondered, why wasn't he in Capra's movie version of it? Why was it Raymond Massey made up so obviously to look like Karloff?
Yeah.
And why not Karloff himself? I mean, there's the famous line in it when Peter Lorre asks Raymond Massey's character, you know, why'd you kill him? You didn't have to kill him. He said, I look like Boris Karloff. And that's in the play.
That's in the play.
And, of course, hugely funny when Karloff comes out on stage and says that. And... You wonder, well, why not this big movie star playing this, and there's some different versions of why this happened in it. Of which, though, was that they needed to keep a certain number of the cast in the Broadway show while the movie. And apparently, Karloff really pushed, saying, "Look, the two ladies, the two older women who were the leads, you need to take them for the movie. They need it for their career. And he'll stay and do." So he passed up on the movie version of it.
Wow.
But the other thing that's fascinating about it was the play launched in 1941. It was this huge hit. Immediately there were productions in other countries. Just a financial windfall. These producers, Lindsay and Krause, who put this show on, just seem like really that rarity of true gentleman producers who were just having fun. And every time the show would become more successful, the whole crew was sharing in that success.
Oh, wow.
And, you know, they would get their weekly rates doubled. And so it's fun reading about this show. But one of the things that was really smart and amazing by today's standards, Frank Capra and I forget which studio it was, but bought the movie rights almost immediately as soon as this was a hit.
Yeah.
And Frank Capra's production went in 1932. But they weren't allowed to release it until the show's contractual run and tour was over.
Oh.
So that's why I don't think it came out till 1945.
Yeah. Because that's right. Yeah, I'm surprised because when you say 1932, I'm like, wait,
42.
Yeah, it was like, yeah, no, I thought it was a post-war movie, but it was after. Wow.
Yeah, and they had made it several years earlier.
Isn't that something? And so he was doing 8 shows a week, I guess, and doing the tour as well,
and then touring, and his not replacement, but when he was on Broadway and they started the tour, and then they cast a certain actor to play his part. And then when he left to fulfill a movie contract, the person who filled in for him on Broadway and then stayed there when Karloff went on tour to San Francisco and Chicago and all this, was Eric von Stroheim. Isn't that fun?
That's hilarious.
So I'm reading that.
Great.
From one book about a Hollywood legend to a book written by a contemporary voice of independent cinema who I've told you before, I when we were doing our top 10 show, I think, and I was mentioning some of the films that maybe didn't make my runner-up, made my runner-up, rather.
Right.
I asked why Dean Haglund is not a fan of Miranda July, because everything about her and her approach seems to be right up your alley.
We
seem
to
have a lot to talk about with each other. Anyway, I'm reading her book, It Chooses You.
Ah!
And this book is about a process she undertook while she was writing her last film, The Future.
Right.
And this, of course, is the woman who starred and wrote the auteur, as we'll talk about later, behind, oh my goodness, Me, You, and Everyone
Me,
We Know.
You. Right.
And The Future. And what the book reveals is that when she was writing The Future, she got kind of stuck in this one place, and her way out of it was just to change her process altogether. She started investigating people who put ads in the Penny Saver.
Right.
And she said, "I would like to come in." So she would pick out objects that she found interesting that she might want to buy.
Right.
But she would call the people up and say, "I want to look at it, but I would also like to interview you, if I may. Record it, and then have a still photographer take pictures of you, and I'll pay you $50. And can I do this?" And so the book becomes about the interviews with the people in the Penny Saver. And it is alternately hilarious and makes me cry. And it's a beautiful read.
Wow.
And she has a wonderful voice written, you know, in book form. And I find her voice in films. Like I said, she has made these two films and they were many years apart. And for me, anyway, I think it might be a good thing that they were many years apart, because for me, her voice in film is not an acquired taste, but it could very easily become too much.
Right.
But this book is wonderful.
Fascinating. Oh, that's cool.
And of course, like you, she's an artist, and she's a performance artist. She's a painter. She's a performance artist. She's a writer.
Does it all.
She can't hold down a steady job.
I know the feeling.
A letter from May 31st.
Oh, yes. That was a good day.
Phil and Dean.
Yes. That's us.
Yes. I've been catching up on Chill Pack Hollywood Hour, and I've been listening to various comments on how venue and mood can affect the movie watching experience.
Yes.
Sometimes where you're sitting in the audience. No, that would be a live event. It occurs to me that in the 1990s, when I used to frequent movie theaters much more often than I do now,
right.
I had a strong desire to like the movies I went to see. We've talked about this.
Yes,
about
people, really.
When you pay. This is why cinema scores are artificially high. Like, you'll always hear, oh, a film got a B audience score? Well, that's a pretty good film.
Yeah.
No, if that's the grade on opening night, that's a pretty bad
film. That's a pretty bad
film. Because people are inclined to want to like a movie.
You'd really be excited to go, yeah.
Because, especially the more it costs.
Yeah.
I want to know that it's been worth the
And it's a big night out. You're full of anticipation.
The hope engendered by the trailers, or perhaps hype is the better term, gave me an expectation of the film that I should like the film.
Ah.
But after a few disappointing films following good trailers, I decided I needed to rule out my own mood as a factor. What I would do is purchase a king-size Reese's Peanut Butters cup and a large lemon-lime drink.
Wow.
During the previews, I would eat all the candy and drink half the soda.
Right.
I had determined that if after starting with a sugar high, I still disliked the film, the film really was a stinker.
There's nothing like artificially inducing a mood injunct through chemical processes to enjoy a movie.
Obviously, venue is a factor as well.
Yes.
But you can't always see the movies you want to see in the venue you prefer. But I figured mood was a larger contributing factor to my enjoyment. And so the point to this story is to inquire, do you have a ritual that you use to put yourself in a specific frame of mind to watch films? I ask because I have noted the use of ritual a few times in the shows I've been listening to recently.
Oh.
And with the importance such rituals seem to have in the business as usual versus hidden knowledge conspiracy illustrations of the truth is out there.
Now look at that.
And I apologize if I'm misinterpreting this, as I have not seen the film yet, even though you've had screenings here in Arizona. I'm behind on the podcast and only found out afterwards.
Ah.
From your interviews for the films, are you finding rituals to be a factor in conspiracy theories and theorists? So we've got two things, any rituals
right.
about seeing films, and then rituals and a factor in conspiracy theories and theorists. And this is from LeJohn Johnson, the venerable Pooh.
Of course.
And, oh, by the way, why don't I mention here that, you know, anyone who is interested in Truth is Out There, we are now setting up a bunch of screenings again.
Are we? Yes, good.
Baltimore is about to get announced. Denver is about to get announced.
Looking that.
So people can find out. We also will have a street date very soon. Possibly by next week's show, we'll have a street date for the Blu-ray.
You couldn't be more
so
excited.
People can always find out the latest information at truthisoutthere.com with dashes in between.
Right.
Truth-is-out-there.com.
So easy.
If they go to truthisoutthere.com, they go to a site for the rapture.
You don't want that.
And we love everything they're doing, but that's not our site. Truth-is-out-there.com. Okay, so any rituals that you partake in before seeing a movie to get yourself in the frame of mind?
Well, there's, of course, the trailer review. And my girlfriend and I, we have the one squeeze, two squeeze. One squeeze for yes, two's for no, by hand-holding whether we want to see the movie based on the trailer. So that's just an emotional, visceral reaction from marketing to the brain to a man, woman, like who's it marketed to and who wants to go. And so that's often a ritual we do. Other than that, there's no specific foods. Generally, it's just water and popcorn. We're not big on the treats because, you know, for the cost of the bag of M&Ms, it actually works out to a dime per M&M peanut. I counted the M&M peanuts when one horrible movie. How many I got versus how much I paid. And it was 10 cents per M&M peanut, which I thought was extraordinarily a ripoff. So that ended the buying of the candy treats. So that's about it for the rituals I can think of.
I try to avoid trailers altogether.
Oh, you do?
Until after. Sometimes I'll watch the trailer after to see how it was marketed. I mean, right. Obviously, if you're seeing films in theater, you're going to see trailers. Though very few of the movies I see trailers to do I want to see.
Right.
It's a way of getting out of them. See, you know, I do see more than 100, 150 new releases each year. So I do
right.
see many, many films from around the world. But again, it's surprising how you know, look, most trailers that play in theaters are of a very narrow range of movies.
And you do go to the DGA to
and
watch
many
them.
Of the films that I see at the Directors Guild, and so it's trailer free. And there is a certain ritual behind that.
Right.
There is, you know, the waiting in line and seeing the same people and having a certain respect for it. You know, no candy, no food is allowed. There's no speaking. Nobody's on their phones.
Right.
You know, they get turned off. The overture, there's an overture before the film starts, a few minutes to let you know.
What a live band.
Everything down. No, they play part of the soundtrack for the film.
Right.
So that you know that it's time to get into it. But so there's those kinds of rituals. With those films that we're going to be seeing at the DGA, the ritual for me in advance is I will go to Rotten Tomatoes and I will look at what kind of critical consensus is building about the film.
Some of
these films have just opened, some have yet to come out.
So and you've already made up your mind?
No,
then?
I've just been trying to avail myself. I don't read about the plot. What I try to do is just have in my mind what the conversations is that seems to be forming
right.
around the film.
Right.
So that...
When you see it...
When I see it...
You know what to converse about.
Especially if... is often the case, a film stops working.
Has that happened?
Yeah, it stops working. No, I mean it stopped, the storytelling stops
working.
Oh,
right. I thought you meant the screen goes blank.
Then I can start assessing it in context with maybe some of the criticisms. And contrary-wise, if it is working for me, I can start to say, okay, why is this? I try to approach it like a learning experience.
Right.
Because that's really what I'm availing myself of. It is enjoyable, and sometimes I really have those experiences of forgetting myself and really loving a movie, like when I saw Inception. However, this is an industry crowd.
Right.
And for the most part, it isn't... That's not the most enjoyable way to see the film. It is enjoyable in the lack of distraction. It isn't enjoyable in the sense that if you're seeing a crowd-pleasing movie, like I mentioned, seeing The Avengers the second time, it wasn't nearly as much fun as seeing it with a paid crowd.
Right.
Because this was an industry crowd, and as we know, like if you've made a comedy, oh my God, that's the worst.
They don't
show
it
too. Because they kind of sit on their hands a little bit.
Right, and they go, oh, well, that's funny.
That's funny.
That's funny.
I saw two films this weekend at the DGA. I saw the new Woody Allen, To Rome with Love.
Yep.
And I tweeted that afterwards. I said, you know what you don't need to say at the end of a Woody Allen movie? That was funny.
That was funny, no, yeah.
How about was it any good? That's the question with Woody Allen these days.
Yeah,
I
right.
mean, he can find some jokes and mine some comedic territory just by falling out of bed in the morning.
Right.
It is who he is. And indeed, this movie was funny. It also is a good 40 minutes longer than it ought to be.
Uh-huh.
I long still for those days of the tight 80-minute comedies that he would make.
Yeah.
And it's four different storylines that are weaved together sort of artfully, played well by the actors. Again, though, each sequence is just one joke that gets milked.
Oh, geez. So it's four short films.
This is one of those ones where it's almost like we've talked about before. It seems like he's at that age where he'll do a Midnight in Paris and then he needs to take a couple films off.
Yeah.
But he has to keep working to stay in practice.
Right. Well, and he's also got a machine, a whole bunch of people that just start the next film as soon as the first one's finished. So
I also saw a new one from I think the directorial debut from Alex Kurtzman, and co-written with his writing partner Orci. You know, these guys wrote Star Trek for J.J. Abrams, the Transformers movies, and they wrote, directed, produced this film, and it's called People Like Us. The title never occurs in the film. It was originally called Welcome to People, which does occur in the film, and is a better title, I think, because I have no idea whether the movie is now actually called People Like Us or People Like Us. I have no idea which it's supposed to be.
Double entendre.
This stars Chris Pine, who has every, you know, who I love.
You do?
Captain Kirk.
That was great.
I tolerated him in This Means War.
Yes.
With Tom Hardy.
You enjoyed the train, runaway train thing?
He was very good in that. He has all the, what's the word for the energy that Tom Cruise has?
Manic?
That manic energy. He has all the manic energy. Unlike Tom Cruise, he does play relaxed very well.
Right.
So he's working really hard in this thing. It's a family drama with Michelle Pfeiffer and Elizabeth Banks. I actually got into an argument with people afterwards. I think Elizabeth Banks will be remembered at Oscar time because I think this film will do well. DreamWorks is behind it, and God knows they got to push something for awards. That's not to say that it's worthy.
Ouch.
I'm just saying it'll be remembered.
I see.
And it's a film that is, again, so neat. Everything's so tidy,
right?
So neat, so constructed, because again, there's so much money behind it that it has to be
right. No, Lucy, you can't just go off on tangents on the day of the
well,
shooting,
and
whatever.
You can't allow, you can't allow for the actors to find something unexpected,
right?
Everything has to be pre-plotted out,
right?
So you are more or less, much like the experience I had with The Best Exotic Marigold Hotel, a movie where, like I said, it's set in India, in a low-rent hotel, but even the dust and the dirt was neat.
Right.
Right?
It set
was perfectly set.
Yeah.
And it is this thing. Everything's pre-plotted, and so you do spend half the time aware that you're just waiting for them to hit certain moments.
There
isn't ever any sense of... What's going to happen? What are they about? There isn't any discomfort. And that's the thing that's so disappointing, especially for drama, is,
you want a little discomfort.
Yeah.
A couple little
tangents.
Because
you want to care that much.
That's right. Want to be unprepared and have the unexpected happen.
So I guess to answer the question, this was that's the ritual that I do when I go to the DGA.
Right.
The ritual when I have as a paying customer is I try... back to what the Venerable Pooh said, I try to go to theaters I love.
Right.
I try to go to theaters that I enjoy having. The Vista, Los Feliz 3, the Arclight,
the
Discount Theater in Pasadena that I love, the Academy, which will go to see movies that I know are probably not very good, but I'm going to go and pay a couple bucks to see them because, you know what? I would rather see this on the big screen than on video.
Right.
And it costs a couple bucks, and I'm glad to have a discount house, especially for those movies that I think could be really good that I missed because we were traveling.
Right.
Movies stay in theaters such a short amount of time now.
Yes.
So there's always this sense that...
I don't know this discount house, the Academy.
The Academy, it's great.
Where is it?
Regency now runs it. It's on Colorado. It's over near... it's just east of Lake, but it's in the Lake District. It's near the Playhouse.
Oh,
it's
really?
Near Boston Court Theater. And it's fantastic. And
sounds great.
Like this week, I'm going to go see, if I get the chance, A Cabin in the Woods
and
21 Jump Street.
Ah.
So I what like a great double going bill. To theaters that I love because then I know I'm supporting a place that I want to have. So even if the movie turns out to be less than... I still feel good about
going. Yeah.
And that's an important one.
Absolutely, because that's sort of how movie going used to be, that it was like you just go to your weekly night out of the movies was at your local movie house and you would watch whatever, particularly when they were one screen, and then you would just go and see that one movie that week. Also when it was cheaper too, right? When it was like $5 or whatever, you didn't give, if it stunk, it didn't matter. Because it was only $5. Now if it's like $25 and it stinks, then you're like angry.
This question of rituals in conspiracy theories and theorists, should we table that for maybe a discussion a little bit more into talking about the things we've been learning about making, especially Truth About Film 2 and 3?
Why don't we table that? Yeah. Because
I will share the
half-hour conversation.
In another book that I've been reading, Manifesting Change by Mike Dooley, who did Lost in Space that I read not too long ago. He does these notes from the universe, and I don't know if I can. I can probably dial this up and read the exact quote. So maybe I'll end with this, but it involves rituals. So I will dial this up and share this at the very tail end of the show.
Very good.
What I'd love to mention though is I was talking about two kind of polished. Films with good-sized budgets. It's not like Woody Allen makes huge budget films.
No.
But it's a beautiful travelogue of Rome, beautiful stars in beautiful places, and there's just nothing really unexpected about it, right? It's not Midnight in Paris.
Right, but Midnight in Paris wasn't even that unexpected.
I think what was unexpected about Midnight in Paris was the theme and the exploration of the theme about the fiction of the Belle Epoque.
Right.
And the fallacy of that, sentimentalizing the past. And what was unexpected about that was that that came from Woody Allen.
Right. Who seems to...
to champion that kind of sentimentality. Not
right.
Sentimental might not be the right word, but that sort of world weariness that he has always seemed to carry, that
there used to be a better time.
There used to be a better time.
Right. And then actually examining that, going, there wasn't a better time.
You know, he was the perfect person to be doing that.
Yes.
And to bring a lightness to that rather than some kind of melancholy examination of it.
Yeah.
It was really
a surprise.
That was surprising.
Right.
It was.
Yeah.
And quite honestly, again, it is still a little bit of a surprise. It is sort of unexpected when Woody Allen seems really fully vested in something.
True, right?
As an actor, he's fully vested in To Rome with Love, and it's delightful to see him as an actor.
Right.
He looks great.
Does he?
Yeah, he's 76. Looks really great.
Working out?
He always was a boxer.
Oh, that's
People
right.
Forget
yeah,
that.
I forget.
But he has put on a little bit of weight, a little muscle mass in it. Looks
oh, really?
Healthy.
Hit the gym. Good for him.
But I saw two films. Well, I did see a film in theaters that I know you are not going to see, even though it's the best review to the film of the year so far. And it opened Cannes. And it's Wes Anderson's latest, Moonrise Kingdom.
Yeah, I'm not going.
And this is a very touching film about children who fall in love. And Bruce Willis does maybe his best work.
I heard that.
And it's... I would put it just below, I'm not saying which one is better, but I'm doing this in chronological order. I would just put it below Rushmore and Royal Tenenbaums.
Oh, okay.
In Wes Anderson's oeuvre.
I did like Rushmore. Royal Tenenbaums, so it's below Royal Tenenbaums, you say?
Yeah, which I think is his masterpiece.
Is it really?
Yeah.
Okay. I still think Rushmore beats Tenenbaums, but... You know,
see, I thought Tenenbaums was the work of a really mature artist, and then I've felt that he's been struggling to get back to that point again.
Interesting. Okay, well then maybe I will see it. I wasn't, I've been burnt by Anderson movie before, and so it was hard for me to go, oh, I'm going to jump out of my chair to get to that one.
But I saw Pariah. This is an independent film that got a lot of acclaim when it came out at the end of last year, and in a lesser year, probably would have got some award play, like Push did, right?
Yeah.
And really the only award acclaim that this film got was when Adepero Ojue, and I don't know if I'm mispronouncing her name.
I think you did a good job.
A beautiful young actress who is the lead in this film, Pariah, when she was named by Meryl Streep in an acceptance speech.
Wow.
As one of the people in the year really deserving of Best Actress Awards.
Wow.
And, of course, didn't get nominated. I mean, it was a year with Meryl Streep's and Glenn Close's and, all these big
names.
Time actresses who were at the top of their game getting really good chances. There's no way for someone like this to break through. But she plays a high school student who is in New York. I think it's Brooklyn.
Mm-hmm.
It's an African-American family. And she's a lesbian, and she knows she's a lesbian, and how she has to keep that hidden from her parents.
That's the pariah that they talk about?
Yes.
I see.
And it's a wonderfully heartfelt film, and has just, those moments of just authenticity that can only happen in a film where they can maybe take the time and have the chance to do it. And
is this a new release too?
It came out on video fairly recently.
Right, so... Meryl Streep knew about it. Was she referring to this actress in this movie?
Yes, because it was released before the end of the year.
Oh,
it
was. Hoped
that it could get award consideration.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a wonderful film to check out from Dee Reese. And
Pariah.
It is available. Another one that is about to come out that we talked about on this show. It comes out on July 10th. It's The Return of Margaret.
The Chill Pack Hollywood Explanation of the Week.
Kenneth Lonergan's long-awaited follow-up to You Can Count on Me. It is being released in a two-version edition.
Oh.
Both the 2.5-hour theatrical release, if you can call it the release. It wasn't released so much as it escaped.
Yes.
And a director's version.
How long is that?
Probably 2 hours and 40 or something like that.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, just reading more and more about this, it is just this incredible story behind the making of this, of a man who made a film that everyone said was a masterpiece at 3 hours. And everyone, including him, knew that it was too long at 3 hours, that we don't live in an era where that is allowed. So he tried to find a way to make it shorter. And he spent his own money keeping the editing room open. His best friend, Matthew Broderick, who appears in the film, gave him $300,000
wow.
to keep the editing room open for a year.
Scott Rudin
went back, backed him on this because he said, look, when you've hired Kenneth Lonergan to make a movie, you want a Kenneth Lonergan movie.
Yeah.
And of course, Scott Rudin's no stranger to battling with artists, but this is someone he respected, and he respected how hard he was working, and he placed the blame on the investors. And on Gary Gilbert, who he said, you know what, when you invest in a movie, when you back a movie, you have, you know, you're saying, look, these are the people who are going to make the movie, and you have to let them do it.
Right.
And if you don't, nothing good can ever come of second guessing them, of challenging them, of trying to get involved.
Right.
And indeed, they have no real recourse to get involved. However, what happened here was that when the movie was finished and released and given to 20th Century Fox, and there were now three different versions of it.
Of course.
There was Lonergan's version, there was the investor's version. They hired an editor, the investor.
Oh, dear.
Hired Dylan Tickner. He did a version that was 2 hours. And then Martin Scorsese did a negotiated version
right.
That would have had the added benefit not only of being approved by Kenneth Lonergan, but now you could put Martin Scorsese Presents on the marketing of it, and both the director and Scott Rudin and 20th Century Fox approved of that,
right?
And then the investor didn't approve on it because he had gotten to the point where he just really he felt pissed off and he was gonna just, you know, cut off his nose to spite his face.
Right.
And is still kind of doing that with this film. But it really was this interesting thing that came back to, they made a masterpiece at 3 hours and they just thought they couldn't release it, but it was a house of cards that from that point, you know, trying to move it down hurt. And I said that when I saw the film, it reminds me of Magnificent Ambersons, really,
right,
in a degree,
right.
That you know you're watching greatness and you also know there are threads that are leading nowhere, and you want to know where those threads lead. So I'm really looking forward to the full release of this.
You know, I think about the filmmaking environment when I hear these stories, and I go, how would Dances with Wolves have been in this environment today? Like, even at Kevin Costner, who wasn't that big a star when he did that. He directed, wrote half of it, subtitled. It was 3 hours plus. And it went on to win all the awards.
I'm going to skip this week's Chill Pack Hollywood Lawsuit of the Week.
Great.
Because you brought up Kevin Costner, who is back in the saddle again.
Yes.
He's riding high.
Speaking
with the
which.
Huge success of Hatfield and McCoy's.
Yeah.
This 6-hour miniseries at a time when no one makes miniseries anymore. And I've
know.
Been saying, we, you know, there's got to be miniseries. Have you seen this?
I just saw a part of it. I haven't got it.
Huge ratings. I mean, was it the History Channel?
It's the History Channel.
13 million viewers per night? I mean, that would make it like a top 10 network show.
Absolutely, yeah.
And I love the fact that no one could get a hold of him to tell him what a huge success he had, because he was off the coast of Africa on one of his dives. You know, he's involved in marine exploration.
That's right.
Sort of stuff.
Because he's got the oil.
So they couldn't reach him to let him know that he's back, baby.
You're back, baby. You can drop that oil reclamation gear that you have been out in the BP oil spill with. And come back to making Hatfield McCoy movies.
Speaking of people who are back, you see that Arsenio Hall is returning to late night TV?
Yes. What?
His talk show is coming back to late night TV. It's going to air only in 52% of the markets at this point. But yeah, late night talk show, Arsenio Hall.
A lousy interviewer.
It was a huge... Oh, well, that stops people. Yeah, because Leno and... I mean, all these people are great interviewers.
Oh, yeah.
But remember, he had a...
It was kind of
really
a fun show.
He made a mark when he was opposite Carson.
Yes.
He had a niche audience. It wasn't like he peeled away from... He catered to an audience that was not being catered to in late night.
Right.
Then when Leno took over, you know, Arsenio, I'm going to kick Leno's ass... But by the time Letterman then moved to 11:30, and it was
everybody
people
was
had
in
too
it
many
was,
choices and
yes.
moved on.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
It'll be interesting.
I guess. I don't know.
There's a show I wanted to ask you about that I actually watched a little bit of when I was in the UK, where it seems to be very popular.
Oh.
Portlandia.
Oh yeah.
Have you seen any of this?
I have.
Because you watched a certain seminal work featuring Kyle MacLachlan last week, and I was wondering if you're watching his current work on Portlandia.
I just saw an episode. It was a little too, well, I mean...
Does it have the wry detachment that you don't like with Wes Anderson?
Kind of.
It seemed like it
might. Yeah, it's just a little too hipster thin, maybe. I don't know what the term is, but it seems to be quite popular. I mean, it's groundbreaking, and it's... format, one would say, but I haven't really got into it. Should I? Is all of London clamoring for this thing?
It's popular and it's being pushed for Emmy consideration this year. We'll see if it happens.
Wow!
But I just I was just curious.
No,
you know?
Okay. Portland. You know what the other big hit in England was when I was over there doing the Fringe Festival? Nip and Tuck. Nip and Tuck was like number one rated in the UK, whereas here it was. All right.
Well, we received a note from a listener.
Yes.
In Dublin, Ireland.
Oh, yes.
Barry.
Hi,
from
Barry.
Dublin, Ireland.
Playing
hey, guys.
There.
Just a few words off the back of your latest podcasts.
Uh-huh.
Re-Prometheus. I enjoyed this a bit more than those I went to see it with. Visually impressive. No real overkill in the action department. A few daft moments, of course, but the big life philosophy stuff posed by Damon Lindelof's writing, I'm not a bitter ex-Lost fan, by the way. I haven't seen Veep, but you should definitely check out The Thick of It. It's superbly written and realized, full of humor, and the dialogue is electric.
Oh.
I believe the same guy wrote Veep.
Oh.
One criticism I've heard of Veep is that you don't feel as if anyone's job is under threat, whereas the reverse is very much the case with...
The Thick of It.
So I'm looking forward to The Thick of It.
Yes.
I must say, Barry, that that criticism, if that's what you've heard, that no one's job is in jeopardy... could not be more off base. In the first few episodes, that was, but by the end of the eight episode season,
yeah,
even the vice president looks like she's going to be
out of a job,
replaced. Spoiler alert.
Right.
So they really do bring that in.
I see.
But they bring it in slowly. They don't hit you with that pressure right away.
I get it.
And which is one of the reasons it took me a little bit of time. It took me like 3 episodes before I went, okay, this
is what you're watching.
Mm. And thank God on HBO you get a chance to find your footing like that. But I'm
Rare.
Looking forward to The Thick of It. So
yes.
I will find this.
Where is that going to be?
He says the axe could fall on anyone at any time. The British are rather good at this stuff. See also House of Cards from the 1990s.
Yes, I remember that.
As for Aaron Sorkin's The Newsroom... I'm also looking forward to this. I liked the first trailer a lot, but the second one has me concerned they'll all be overly self-aware, which was a weakness of The West Wing.
Yeah.
Fingers crossed it will be more successful than Studio 60. The premiere was last night. You watched
it? Yes. No, I didn't. But I heard a lot of criticism about it, and I heard that the self-aware issue is
absolutely
taking it down.
The Jesse Eisenberg cameo was irritating and a distraction. The self-awareness, which is self-aware in and of it, you know, itself.
Some
oh, and they know the audience will be self-aware of, oh, that's the guy that starred in Aaron Sorkin's movie. Won't
right.
that be a great moment?
Oh.
That should be one of the most dramatic moments in the... And instead you're going, hey, that's Jesse Eisenberg.
Right, totally takes you out of it.
It isn't The West Wing. It does... I am reserving judgment in the sense that it was a pilot.
Yeah.
Does it show possibility? Absolutely. And look, any show that gives Jeff Daniels a good character to play has hope. I mean,
that's
this
right.
guy is one of the most unheralded quality actors.
I know.
And unheralded because this is a man who has passed up much work in his life because he wanted to stay close to his family. He wanted to be a father family. To his children. He wanted to be a family man, so he's worked, done a lot of theater locally where they live, and you know, so.
And does that explain Dumb and Dumber?
That was a long time ago. That was a long time ago.
I'm just saying.
The sequel Jim Carrey just left the sequel. Did you see that?
No.
Because he doesn't think the studio's enthusiastic enough for it. Wow.
Wow.
That just seems like all full of euphemisms. Anyway, I like Barry, fingers crossed on this. And Barry, thank you for bringing us. We will look up.
The thick of it.
The thick of it. The one thing about Newsroom is I hope that it could serve... especially as we lead up to an election, because I got to tell you, you know, if I get one more email from any one of my friends on either side of the political spectrum about how terrifying the prospect of the other guy winning is, you know, it just makes you not want to even participate.
Right, exactly.
You know, I mean,
it's all terrifying.
Everybody's playing the terror card. Everyone's playing the fear card. It's lazy. It's sloppy. It does not invite
discussion.
It does not invite discussion. It does not appeal to the better angels of our nature, of course. But it also doesn't. You know, it basically says, look, you're either with us or against us.
Right. It's binary all of a sudden.
And when we win, you're out. And if you win, we're out. As opposed to, look, at what point have we ever needed to be more together than right now? And no matter who wins, do we all need to make sure that we are still credible messengers and allowed to be a part of a conversation so that our ideas can be heard?
And diminish and erase this binary, polar, left-right, whatever monikers as a way of defining thoughts and ideas and solutions to problems, whatever they may be, you know, that you're not going to find these with labels. You're not going to find solutions through the application of pre-existing constructs that don't even apply in this world anymore.
And there is the degree to which, obviously, politicians have brought this all on themselves.
Yes.
Right. And
and that the press then concludes because
absolutely.
You drop it down to 5-second bites of sound that you then that make these constructs rigid.
And as I always say about us, the voting populace, look, we've got a lot on our plate. We have a lot to worry about. You know, we send these people to Washington. We have these people who are paid to be journalists to do certain work for us.
Right.
To serve us, and they are failing us.
They are.
And they are all failing us. And so you know what that means? Well, no matter how much work we have to do, we have to do better.
Right.
We have to do better. Hmm. And we have to be better.
Well, it's true.
And then demand better from the people who serve us through broadcasting or even podcasting.
Or podcasting.
And through our elected officials.
Wow. So it comes back to our responsibility.
Two celebrity deaths.
Uh-oh.
Celebrity deaths.
I can't let a week go by without remembering a character actor, because you know how much I love character actors.
I know.
Supporting players. Richard Lynch, 76. Very famous for that scarred face he had that he got after a 1967 fire.
Oh, I didn't realize that.
That he was in. Probably best known for the villainous characters he would play in movies like Bad Dreams and The Sword and the Sorcerer. As a kid, though, growing up in the 70s, I remember him from playing recurring heavies on shows like Battlestar Galactica and A-Team.
Yeah.
And then later on 6 Feet Under. And he was a wonderful... wonderful character actor, Richard Lynch. He died at 76.
76.
Andrew Saris, kind of the dean of American film critics.
Oh, 80, yes.
He died at 83. When he was with the Village Voice and later the New York Observer, he championed the wave of foreign filmmakers.
Mm-hmm.
Foreign film really got a foothold in this country in the 60s.
Coined the term auteur?
He did not coin the term auteur. He translated the Cahiers du Cinéma articles, and he helped bring that theory, for good and for ill, these shores. Many people, like Vince Gilligan has talked about on this show, that the worst thing that ever happened was the director as auteur.
Right.
That theory. But it also is, in some ways, the best thing that ever happened, in that, again, it inspires a different way of having the conversation about film. And we cannot argue that there are filmmakers who are best appreciated when you realize that they are those kind of artists where every film that they do is part of a larger canvas
that they're working on.
Recognizing it in context gives you greater understanding and greater enjoyment of their work. Stanley Kubrick was certainly an artist like this.
Yeah.
Alfred Hitchcock was the American filmmaker who was really championed by the French in this, because here was a man who never, quote unquote, wrote his own films,
right?
And yet
they
he's
are
the writer of his films.
Exactly.
They are identifiably Hitchcock, and he was working through thematic material throughout
his whole career.
So this is a critic who, whether you agree with that theory or disagree with this theory, this is a critic who contributed to the conversation about film, and that's why we had so much fun reading quotes from some of our friends who were critics last week on the show about Prometheus, because they contribute to conversation.
And to close the show, do you have your quote?
I do have the quote.
Let's hear
it. But we'll remind people that we do have a Kickstarter campaign
we want
them to check out.
Check
Hieroglyph of the Human Soul. We'll have the link on the page. Like us on Facebook.
Please like
Facebook.
Us.
Facebook.com, ChillPackHollywood.
Yes.
Follow us on Twitter.
I'm at D. Haglin.
I'm Phil Lairdus. And write us with your questions.
Please do.
ChillPackHollywood@yahoo.com.
It's so easy.
And here's a little something, a note from the universe. Young souls look to secrets, rites, and rituals. Mature souls look to science, math, and evidence. And old souls look within. Look within the universe. P.S. Aren't young souls cute? Till next week, I'm Phil Lairdus.
Dean Haglin.
Belated spoiler alert.